All right, I'm going to call this meeting of the Elections Committee to order. A quorum is present. So today we will be doing the walkthrough of the of our omnibus bill. I can just do that from here. I can just stay here, right? I think I'll just stay up here rather than go to the testimony table, although it is my bill that's the vehicle here. So what we're going to do, we will have nonpartisan staff go through a walkthrough of the bill. First, I asked them to do it fairly high level because most of these are provisions we've seen before. I did ask them to, if there were technical changes or anything like that being made, I asked them just to highlight those just for so members are aware of them. We will take testimony at that point. We have instructed on the committee page that the testimony will only focus on the new provisions because all the existing provisions have already had full testimony. And then we will turn to member discussion of the bill. The intention is to come back Friday. The time has changed from 8:30 to 10:30. At that point, we will do the markup and vote the bill out. So any questions at this point as to how we're proceeding?
Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Representative.
I'm sorry, I wasn't listening for that last part.
I wasn't good at
it. Can you repeat?
For you, Representative Davis, I'll do, yes, anything. Friday, we'd initially posted the meeting for 8:30. It'll be at 10:30 instead. And then that will be when we will be doing the markup of the bill and then voting it out, I hope.
Thank you.
So, okay. So with that, I will turn to nonpartisan staff. Roberts, did you want to go first and go through the spreadsheet? Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members, you have a spreadsheet in your packet. I'm going to walk through it very quickly, focusing on the 24-25 numbers and the changes from the base. The first item is the Attorney General's Office. I'm tracking $400,000 for Representative Greenman's bill prohibiting the intimidation of election officials. And I should point out that the appropriation actually isn't in the bill. That was an oversight, and we will be adjusting that during markup. The next office is the Secretary of State, and the total funding is $2.6 million. You can see the change items listed. Included is the 2023 appropriation for the redistricting litigation fees. I'll move down to line 17. There's a general fund transfer to the local election account. Also, we heard that bill is called the voter account of $2.4 million. And that concludes the Secretary of State. The second agency is the Campaign Finance Board. You can see there are four change items, including the local and political subdivisions lobbying provision, Representative Coulter's bill, and also audit investigations, Representative Coulter's bill. So the total for the Campaign Finance Board is $3.5 million. Then moving down to line 37, there's an increase in the statutory appropriation for the public subsidy program of $2.98 million in 24-25 and $1.2 million in the tails. And so the total, the reconciliation at the end, if you look at the bottom line on line 56, the total elections general fund spending is $24 million for fiscal year 24-25.
Thank you. And Mr. Guerin?
Mr. Chair, so I'll walk through the DE1 amendment that's in your packet. Ms. Roberts covered what's in Article 1, so I'll focus on the rest of the articles in that DE, which start on page 3. And I'll just, for members' information, there should be a table level summary in the packet, or one does exist, and I can send it around after for those who might be interested. High-level overview of the bills that are incorporated into the DE amendment. And as I go through these articles, I'm not going to do a section-by-section walkthrough, but I'm just going to highlight kind of the major policy provisions that the committee has seen previously. So in Article 2, which is the most substantial article of the DE amendment, a lot of the sections in Article 2 come from the Secretary of State's administrative bill, House File 1140, and I'm not going to point those out as we go through, but there's a lot of those. And you'll see that in the summary document. Section 1 on page 3 comes from Representative Brand's House File 811. This is the access to multi-unit apartment facilities and residences by employees of the United States Census. On page four, section two is the policy language that establishes the voting operations technology and election resources account. This is Representative Coulter's bill, 2765, and there's funding in Article One to go into that account for local government election expenses. Then we're going to move ahead to page seven of the DE1. Section four is the first of a number of sections from Representative Purcell's bill. This is the language related to post-secondary institutions and voter registration of those students. Section five of the on page seven is Representative Frederick's 2802, the definition of major political party. And then we're going to move ahead to page 13.
Sorry, there was a request from Representative Quam to say the bill numbers. I don't know if you have those, but I will mention that the summary that Mr. Gehring mentioned, it was provided to GOP research, but our committee administrator just emailed it to all members too, and that should, I believe that also has the, that will have the bill numbers in it. Okay. Sorry, you may continue, Mr. Gehring.
Mr. Chair, yes. So on page 13 of DE1, section 9, again, comes from Representative Purcell's House File 495. This is the student voter registration provisions. And then I'm going to move ahead to page 22, section 20, comes from Representative Bonner's bill. This is the language that allows for the use of an electronic signature on the polling place roster. And then starting on page 24 of the DE1, sections 22 running through section 51, so this is going to span pages 24 to 39. Is a whole bunch of sections that modify absentee voting process and includes the adoption of Representative Frederick's bill related to early voting. That's House File 559. I'm not going to go through all these changes. There's a number of the chair asked for kind of technical changes, and I will just point out that within this span of sections, there's a whole lot of technical things that are included that sort of merged the early voting process with the Secretary of State's administrative provisions related to the way that they were reorganizing the absentee voting chapter. So those are kind of scattered throughout, and they're probably too technical to sort of highlight here, but if members have questions, I'm happy to answer how those are organized. So that'll run from page 24 through page 39 of DE1. At the bottom of page 39, section 53 is Representative Becker Finn's House File 789. This is the language that allows candidates who have a reasonable fear for their safety or the safety of their family to ask that their residential address be classified as private data. And then moving ahead to page 46, section 61 is Representative Frederick's bill, House File 559. Modifies the existing high school student election judge program so that these students are referred to as trainee election judges and allows them to serve in that capacity until they turn the age of 18, even if they've already graduated from high school. Section 66, which is page 49 of the DE1, comes from House File 1942. This is the first of a bunch of sections that allow for the use of multiple styles of voting system in a precinct and multiple ballot styles. And then on page 53 of the DE1, section 72 is represented by Bajay's House File 799. This is the language that allows a person to be absent from work for purposes of early voting and voting in person before Election Day. Section 77 on page 56 is Representative Frederick's House File 95. This is the language that directs the State Canvassing Board to declare a winner based on the candidates who receive the highest number of votes for a federal and state office. Section 83 on page 58 of the DE1 is Representative Stevenson's House File 451. There's a set of sections here that govern the way that partisan candidate names are rotated on the ballot. And then next, I'm going to move to page 71. This is House File 642. This is Representative Freiberg's National Popular Vote Interstate Compact being adopted. And then page 73, section 111, is Representative Greenman's language related to intimidation and interference with the work of an elections official. That's House File 635. Section 112 on page 76 is Representative Bonner's bill, House File 205, that modifies the standards for activities that are prohibited near a polling place on Election Day. And then lastly, in this article, I'll point out on page 80, subdivision one of the repealer comes from, this was an amendment that was adopted to House File 1776. This is repealing the language related to persons who may who are allowed to participate in precinct caucuses. And Mr. Chair, that is the end of the walkthrough for Article 2. And as I said, a lot of the sections I skipped over come from the Secretary of State's administrative bill. And again, if there are questions, I'm happy to go back to those sections and talk about them further. Article 3, the entirety of Article 3 comes from Representative Greenman's House File 3. This is the article that includes pre-registration of voters who are ages 16 and 17. It includes automatic voter registration and the establishment of the permanent absentee voter list, which would provide actual absentee ballots to people on that list, as opposed to the current law, which provides an application to people on that list. And all the language in this article is identical to what's in House File 3, with the exception of a couple of technical updates to conform to the way the bill was drafted in the Senate. And then moving ahead to Article 4, which starts on page 99 of the DE1. This is also an article that comes directly from Representative Greenman's House File 3. This includes the section that provides for translated voting instructions and sample ballots in languages other than English, and also includes civil and criminal remedies for voter intimidation and other actions that are directed towards voters, as opposed to the earlier section, which governed election officials. And that's the entirety of Article 4. And then Article 5 is the campaign finance related article from House File 3. This is the article that includes the expansion of the definition of expressly advocating, which is used to determine whether an expenditure is a campaign expenditure. This includes Representative Stevenson's bill that governs, that prohibits contributions by foreign influence corporations. And in this section, I'm going to point out one new section that the committee hasn't seen before, which is on page 103, section 3 is a new standard that prohibits foreign nationals from making contributions for political purposes in Minnesota. And then Article 6, moving on to page 107, comes from not from House File 3, but from the set of campaign finance related bills that the committee has heard this session. These bills are all sort of scattered throughout, so I'm not going to go section by section. I'm just going to point out that within this article is House File 2394. This is Representative Freiberg's bill that updates the form of the economic interest statement. This includes Representative Coulter's bill, House File 1776, that expands the definition of lobbying to include lobbying in front of political subdivisions statewide. That includes the Campaign Finance Board's administrative bill with a number of technical updates to Chapter 10A throughout. It includes House File 2393, which is Representative Freiberg's bill that updates lobbyist registration laws. I will point out on the substance, Representative Greenman's House File 2337, this is the bill the committee heard previously that establishes a system of reporting for electioneering communications. So those sections start on first section, section 23, but it's really the sort of late 30s, starting on section 30 through 32 is really the substance of the electioneering communications provisions. And then the last section, Mr. Chair, that I'll point out is section 35, which is on page 134. This is language that governs the, this is amending the existing law that governs contributions during the legislative session. The committee heard the language that prohibits contributions by lobbyists for purposes of attending special events being held. And then it also includes a new paragraph B, which is on line 134.25, that prohibits candidates for the legislature from soliciting contributions or assisting in the solicitation of contributions on behalf of a political party during the legislative session. And Mr. Chair, that's the end of the walkthrough, and I'm happy to take questions.
Thank you, Mr. Gehring. I think we'll turn to the Secretary of State. I think I saw him here. If you'd like to speak to the bill. A second to come down. Welcome to the committee. Mr. Secretary, please identify yourself and then proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Member Steve Simon, Minnesota Secretary of State. We have, I believe, some slides to show you. Okay. Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. The Office of the Secretary of State base budget is being carried in the State and Local Government Finance Committee, as well as any non-election related change items. So I'm just going to limit my remarks here, obviously, to that which is in front of this committee and the purview of the committee, which I think we've discussed before. Excuse me. One of the first things that I always mention when I'm speaking about our budget is the fact that we provide $27 million more to the general fund than we cost. So we're a small profit center for the state. So if you add everything up in our office, every person, every paperclip, everything, we make $27 million more than that. And that's, I think, a relevant place to start. That net contribution comes from the Business Services Division within the Office of Secretary of State, obviously not a part of this committee, but I think it's relevant for you to know that. These are the fees that we charge for things like business filings, and they are set in state statute. You all in the legislature set those fees. We don't. And many of them haven't been raised or lowered or touched in any way since the 1980s. I just mention this because I think it's important to remember that we make significantly more money than our office costs. I also want to ground the discussion in a little history of the general funding for the Office of the Secretary of State's base budget. So, as you'll see in this next slide, not adjusting for inflation. This is not adjusting for inflation. We are essentially at 2002 funding levels. So there's been no growth despite growing needs across all divisions of the Secretary of State. Now, in the next slide, you'll see what happens when you adjust for inflation. When you adjust for inflation, looks even worse. The base budget of the office has been substantially reduced over the last 20 years if you factor in inflation. So before I go into our budget requests that are before this committee, I just want to remind you of one thing that I shared during my office overview some weeks ago, and that is that our office serves the entire state of Minnesota. The election-related staffing within our office is quite lean. The elections division of the office is only 21 full-time employees and one general counsel, our chief lawyer, that serves the entirety of the office. So this is a person, Bebe Black. She's been with the office for over 40 years. She serves the entire office, not just the elections part of the office. So nine of those employees of the 21, nine of the employees, including our elections director, serve as elections administrators, basically supporting primarily the 87 counties and hundreds of municipal election workers. The office also maintains nine IT staff supporting our many online tools for voters, and crucially, the statewide voter registration system, or SVRS. Many of you know, since 2002, a federal law that was passed, the Help America Vote Act, every state in the country has to have something like that. They go by different names in different states. Ours is the SVRS, statewide voter registration system. It cost millions to build back then. It cost millions to maintain. It's sort of the spine of the system. And then there are other tools, such as the election night reporting tool, candidate filing systems, among others. And new to the office is an elections cyber navigation, or what we really call a security navigation program. These are two staff funded by the Help America Vote Act funds, which you have made available to us through matching money. And they are tasked with working with all 87 counties to help secure our election systems. That can include physical security. It includes cybersecurity. It really runs the gamut. And finally, we have one full-time voter outreach professional and a temporary voter outreach team member as well. It's a small team, it's a mighty team, but it supports all 87 counties, thousands of election workers from township clerks to county auditors, tens of thousands of election judges, obviously, and over 3.6 million registered voters in Minnesota. And that leads to the request, and that's what's before you today. This team really needs help. It hasn't had help, substantial help, in a long, long time, even though there are more responsibilities every day, every week, every year. So the request is for $559,000 per year, or $1,118,000 per biennium, to add six FTEs to support our election administration and voter outreach work. And in case you're wondering, you're trying to do the math in your head, that is about an 8% increase above our base budget. So it's about an 8% increase, six FTEs. These six positions would break down this way. Three of the FTEs would be supporting election administration. These are the folks that directly support our county, city, and township and school district election officials, and supporting the voter registration system, the SVRS system, maintained by our office. One FTE would support voter outreach. The need here has absolutely exploded from partners across the state, I mean everywhere, all four corners of the state. And this will ensure that we can continue to partner with businesses, chambers of commerce, schools, nonprofits, other than communities, other communities around the state. They want the materials from us. They want different kinds of materials. They want videos, and that runs the gamut as well. One FTE would be supporting election and voter communications and information. They work with the outreach folks quite closely. It's similar to that. The position supports the work of the office to provide clear and comprehensive and accessible information to the public and voters about the elections process. And the last FTE, quite important, is for a deputy general counsel who would support the one in-house attorney that we have in compliance related to elections. So we have, as I mentioned, one attorney. That's it for the entire office. She's been there over 40 years. She's not going to be there a whole bunch longer. She has a ton of institutional memory, and it's very, very clear, given the uptick in legal activity of all kinds, that we need a second attorney. We just have to. We can't replace that one 40-year veteran with one other person. It's got to be two other people. These additional staff are needed to support the growing needs related to elections in our office. And while there are examples of obvious reasons for these increased needs, the addition of a third statewide election every 4 years, you know, we just had the first presidential nominating primary in a generation in 2020. That's a thing now. So every 4 years, we have not two statewide elections, not a November general and an August primary, but we have a presidential nominating primary that's coming up in less than a year, obviously. But another thing I want to mention is turnover in our partners in the local election administration ranks. Some of you know this from your own districts. There's just been a lot of turnover in the last few years. Since 2020, one in five lead county election officials is new. Sometimes that's retirement, just natural attrition, there are mergers, reorganizations, and the like. But one in five are new. And these are dedicated local election professionals that really are the backbone of the system. There are partners, there are teammates. But an increase in the number of new folks means a lot more training and support needs at the state level. Another less obvious need is related to election equipment certification. That's one of the core responsibilities of that division of our office. And so for a significant period in our modern history, there was really only one primary equipment vendor in the state. Now there are four different equipment vendors certified in the state with 12 different pieces of technology, and that's a good thing. We want there to be variety. We want to have a menu that counties and cities can choose from. We don't just want one giant company, you know, penetrating and having almost total market share. I think it's good. It's not up to us. Remember, we don't own any elections equipment in our office ever. It's the counties and cities that buy their own, and they choose which vendors that they want to use, and that's a good thing. I think that's that healthy competition is good, but that variety comes with a cost, and it means that we have to test and certify each piece of equipment. That's, by the way, a process that's always open to the public. If any of you are ever curious or interested, we always have to notice it publicly, and once in a while we do get legislators that come watch us do the certification process. It usually takes multiple days. We put the machines through the paces. There are a bunch of standards that we have to adhere to. But the growing number of pieces of equipment has put pressure on the administration team that conducts that work. And finally, the work of the team to process grants and reimbursements has grown significantly. So just in the last 5 years or so, since 2017, we've handled over $20 million in state and federal grant funds to be distributed to counties, cities, and townships throughout Minnesota. Just to put that in perspective, in the years between 2011 and 2017, that number was 1 million. So it's gone up 20-fold in the last 5 years. Part of that is because Congress has provided some funds for us to administer, so it sort of goes in a top of a funnel to us. And then at the other end of the funnel is the money that we distribute to counties. And I wish it were as simple as saying it's just formula-based. I mean, that wouldn't take always a ton of effort and people power. But it isn't. We're having to look over receipts and requests and do a lot of analysis and consult with law to see whether someone's request is, you know, meets certain criteria. So it's not just money to us that goes out the other end and we write a check. There's a lot of work involved in that, and that's gone up 20-fold. So I think that context is important. The final two requests I just want to touch on very briefly, Mr. Chair, and I know there's been discussion in this committee. I don't want to belabor it, but just to put a pin in it and mention it for the record. Included in the bill are one-time funding requests. The first of the two is the state match requirement for the Help America Vote Act, or HAVA funds. The second, and this was your bill, Mr. Chair, of course, The second is with respect to the redistricting litigation fees that our office owes as a result of the 2022 redistricting. The committee heard the details of this bill. It was your bill, and I don't know if I need to say much more about that. But I just want to thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for your work on the bills heard this session, which are included in this bill in the delete all amendment, and I'm happy to answer any questions now or later. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Secretary Simon. Maybe you and Nicole Freeman can just stay up there if you're free. I have a feeling some questions might come your way at some point during this discussion. Before we get to member discussions, I just wanted to mention one additional thing as part of the walkthrough. That's because it's a relatively, because it's a new provision here. If you look to line, page 108, line 12, there's addition to the definition of lobbyist in there. And this was a request from Director Sigurdsson of the Campaign Finance Board. When we made a change to law late one night last session to restrict the ability of members of the legislature to work for lobbying firms, we also made a change to the definition of lobbyist. But the impact of that might be to require people to work at the front desk or work in IT for a lobbying firm to have to register as lobbyists, which wasn't really the intention. So. This was this is kind of cleanup language, but it is new. We didn't hear this separately, so I just wanted to draw members' attention to that. It just requires that the individual's job duties include offering direct or indirect consulting or advice that helps the business provide lobbying services essentially to clients. So just wanted to point that out as well, just to make sure members knew that was there. So with that, we can turn to member discussion. Who would like to be recognized? We could also adjourn early if there's no question. Representative Davis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for being here, Mr. Secretary. And let's see. So I'm looking at page 27 of this bill. It says, at the request of federally recognized Indian tribe with a reservation in the county auditor must establish an additional polling place for at least one day. Now, I know this is coming at the request of a federally recognized Indian tribe, but they're asking for at least one day, and the language says at least one day. So I'm guessing that can be as many days as they want. Are you familiar with this part in the bill?
Secretary Simon.
Thank you, Representative Davis. Yes, Mr. Chair and Representative Davis. Yeah, this is part of Representative Frederick's early voting bill, so I would defer. I am familiar with it, but yes, the idea here is that at some point, you know, we have a 46-day absentee ballot period, and there's been a pretty long history, I think, in recent history of counties working with tribal governments to reach an accommodation about whether there should be either a polling place on reservation land on election day, or failing that, whether at some point during the 46-day absentee period they could have that. And state law, the legislature back in 2017 passed a law that was kind of a breakthrough, at least in my judgment, which said that it isn't all or nothing. That the old rule used to be that you either had to have a polling place, an absentee ballot polling place, either all 46 days or not at all. It was zero or 46. There was no in between. And what the legislature said in 2017 was, no, you can have something in between. You can, for example, in the last week of the election, which is by any measurement the week when most people vote absentee, you can have a so-called pop-up, or you can have a temporary polling place on reservation land or any land, any place in any of your districts. And so I think, I don't want to speak for him, but I think what Representative Frederick was getting at here is that under certain conditions, tribal governments would be entitled to some presence. It would be up to the counties and the tribal government, I would imagine, to figure out what is most convenient, what is most cost-effective, but some presence within that absentee period. That's my understanding.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, it's while you were speaking, I kept reading through it. Yeah, it makes sense. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. As long as we're on that particular topic of drop boxes and pop-up polling locations, I guess I might as well ask the Secretary, is anybody who determines those locations, and are there any parameters as to what those locations are, or is it just the choice of the, I just kind of elucidate that.
Yeah,
Secretary Sein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Torkelson. Yeah, great question. I would divide it into two halves. For the game day or election day polling places, that is very clear. December 31st of the year before the election. So this December 31st, everyone in Minnesota by this December 31st has to pick their election day polling places for like 11 months ahead. So we'll have total finality as of this December 31st for election day stuff. But what about the absentee ballot period? There it's murkier, I have to say. There is no hard and fast deadline like there is for an election day polling place. But practically speaking, what I tell groups of all kinds who say, hey, how can we get a polling place changed from point A to point B? When it comes to election day, I tell them, you got till December 31st. When it comes to the absentee ballot period, I tell them, you know, the earlier the better. If you approach a county with an idea to have an absentee ballot location for a day or a week within that 46 days, just from a practical standpoint, I would say the earlier the better. Don't come to them in June or July, because you got to have that, you want some consistency between when it is for the August primary and when it is for the November general. So there's no hard and fast rule, but the earlier the better. I mean, my advice to all manner of community groups, sometimes it's a religious congregation, sometimes it's a student group, is go to your county. They set them. Local government set them. We don't in our office. Go to them early. Go to them this year. And my advice to anyone would be, do it in this year if you can. If you do it next year, in the year of the actual election, go as early as possible. Don't wait till Memorial Day to approach someone. So it really is up to individual counties and their bandwidth, and maybe it's a cost issue, but there is no hard and fast rule like there is on election day. That's totally crystal clear. Election day, December 31st, the year before, you got to set your polling places.
Lead Torkelson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Secretary, for that answer. So then focusing a little more on the absentee ballot locations. Who has the final up or down decision as to whether these are established or not, and in what and you know how many days they're open, that sort of thing.
Secretary Sein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Torkelson, as often happens, Ms. Freeman knows something that I don't. And so if it's okay with you, I'd like to turn this over to her, because she just spotted some language in the bill that both answers this question and will shed some light on your prior question.
Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and then respond to the question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Nicole Freeman, Office of the Secretary of State. On your previous question, Lead Torkelson, Section 36 of the bill does talk about designation of locations and requires the locations that they're talking about in this instance are absentee locations and requires them to be made at least 14 weeks before the election. So any location, whether it's a pop-up or a permanent location open all 46 days, those do have to be designated and then noticed to the Office of the Secretary of State 14 weeks ahead of time. And then as far as who has the authority to make the designation for locations, it would be the authority that is administering absentee voting. So all 87 counties have the authority to administer absentee voting, and some cities also have the authority to administer absentee voting.
Lead Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for that information. So, Mr. Secretary, is there any risk of a biased approach to the establishment of these pop-up polling places, given the political leanings of the body that's making the determination of where they be located, as to which requests they might honor, which requests they might deny, or which spots they might select on their own volition?
Secretary Sein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Torkelson. Absolutely fair question. I would say that, you know, human nature being what it is, I would say the risk is equal to the risk that there are just with regular polling places, right? That happens all the time. I can't say it's any more or less, but you're not wrong to talk about that's some real authority there to pick where a polling place is, whether it's election day or otherwise. Is it possible that someone could do the wrong thing and take political considerations and factor in considerations. I guess it's always possible, any in your district, in my district, anywhere that we live. But I wouldn't say it's any greater in the instance of absentee voting than it is just where regular polling places are. And we regularly hear from folks, you know, we don't have the authority to do it, so they're often disappointed. They'll come to me, any community. Sometimes it's a religious congregation. Sometimes it's a student group, and they'll say, hey, we want to move the election day polling place from point A to point B. It's not fair to our community. First thing I tell them is we don't make the decision. You have to lobby your city or your county. And sometimes whatever group it is will allege some sort of bias, like, well, they're not locating it closer to us because of X. And so you're not wrong to ask that question. I would just say it's no greater a risk than we already have with anyone who sets a polling place.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Secretary. So is there any recourse for these complaints? You indicated you don't have the authority to do anything. Does anyone have any authority over these matters?
Secretary Simon.
Mr. Chair and Representative Ferguson, yeah, the courts do. And you do see litigation from time to time that allege discrimination of some kind. It could be based on religious affiliation in the case of a congregation. It could be based on other factors as well. But the courts can theoretically make a change. If there's evidence that there's some sort of disparate impact or that there's intentional discrimination involved, the courts can intervene. And from time to time, you do see litigation like that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then kind of along these same lines of questioning, when it comes to drop boxes, are they treated in a similar fashion?
Secretary Simon?
Yes, Mr. Chair and Representative Horkelson, yes, I would say the same, right. And you're introducing a fair topic. If there's individual human discretion involved in where to locate, for example, a drop box. Although I will tell you, we haven't had those issues as much in Minnesota. I can tell you just from experience, one of the new businesses we're in because of a law that the legislature passed in 2021 is we have to have on our website, you can go there right now and find it for 2022, a list of every drop box in Minnesota so every Minnesotan can see where they are. And almost universally in the counties that have, by and large in greater Minnesota, it's almost always at the county building or the county courthouse. So there's very little mystery in Minnesota, at least. In other states, there have been knockdown, drag-out battles about where drop boxes are located. We just haven't had that. But to your question, Representative, the courts, again, would intervene or could intervene, I guess, if a case was made, a persuasive case that the location was discriminatory in some way or unfair in some way.
Lee Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the timelines for establishing drop box locations, are they similar or identical to the pop-up locations?
Mr. Chair, Representative Torkelson, I'm going to defer on that one to Ms. Freeman.
Nicole Freeman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Lee Torkelson. I don't have the statutes in front of me since the drop boxes weren't in the bill, but I'm happy to look that up. It's the requirements for drop boxes are defined in statute, and so I'll look that up right now.
Lee Torkelson.
Thank you. That's all I have along those lines right now. Am I the only person asking questions?
At this point, I don't have anyone else on the list. Looking for hands, I'm not
all
seeing
right.
any.
So I'll continue. I'll continue. Then I'd like to switch to the topic of the early voting provisions in this bill. Given the fact that someone who casts a mail-in ballot has an opportunity to claw back that ballot in a certain window of time that is closed once early voting starts. Mr. Secretary, can you talk about the impact of extending this early voting window on the opportunity to claw back your ballot?
Secretary Simon.
Yes, Mr. Chair and Representative Torkelson, again, you raise a very fair issue, and it is a risk. If you early vote in a way that's not absentee balloting, you do forfeit your right to claw back your ballot. It's true. Right now in Minnesota law, we have a provision, as many of you know, that a person can claw back their ballot, meaning let's say they vote on day minus 46, which is the first day of the absentee ballot period, and they see an ad or a debate or they read something or see something or hear something and they say, what have I done? I made a total mistake in that county commissioner race. I can't believe I voted for candidate A. What was I thinking? You can claw back your ballot until day minus 14. That's the current rule. But if someone were to vote pure, like early vote, as the legislation contemplates, and not by absentee, but an actual early vote, same as if it's game day, you're putting it in the ballot box, that is one disadvantage. There are advantages. That wasn't your question, I realize, but one absolute trade-off is you can't claw back your vote. That's true.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I agree with you on that point, but my point was that someone who has a mail-in voter, mails in their ballot prior to the early voting window, can claw back their ballot, is my understanding anyway, I could be wrong, as I often am, up until the time that early voting starts.
Secretary Stein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Torkelson. I'm going to have Ms. Freeman answer that one as well. She has some thoughts on that.
Nicole Freeman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Lee Torkelson. So someone who submits their ballot by mail, whether it's a mail ballot or an absentee ballot, or comes in and votes using the envelope process in person, can claw back their ballot. Currently, up until 7 days, that's when the ballot board begins their work. Under the bill, it will be 18 days when the ballot board can begin their work. And the reason for the sort of stopping of the clawback period is that the envelopes, once the ballot board begins their work, they're separating the signature envelope from the ballot. And so there's no longer a way to, you know, trace back whose ballot is whose.
Thank you. So for many voters, we're eliminating, if this bill goes through as is, we'd be eliminating their opportunity to claw back their ballot, extending that period when they can't claw back by 11 days. You know, we've experienced here in Minnesota some tragedies that happen within that window where people may have wanted to claw back their ballot and recast their vote for a candidate because of something that happened during that time period. And they will no longer have that opportunity because that window is being extended by 11 days. That, to me, is significant. It's not a point that we were able to make earlier in the discussion on these bills. And I think it's an important distinction.
Thank you. Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Madam Chair, or Mr. Chair. And I just wanted to sort of, I think we have not talked yet about the clawback period and the trade-off we're making. What I would say is, and what we heard from election administrators, is voters want the ability to put their ballots directly in the machine. They show up, not have to put in an envelope. There's actually been some skepticism about, like, why do I need to put my ballot in an envelope? Why can't I put in a machine the same way I can the last 7 days? Then I can see it go into the machine. I can see the counter. That's what this bill does. This bill says for 18 days, voters can show up and they can put their ballot in the machine. When you also talk to elections administrators and you ask them how many times people use that clawback provision, I have heard tens of times per county or total. And so that it's a worth engaging your elections administrators to say, when we think about what voters are actually asking for and need, what they're hearing is people want to put their ballots in the machines. The clawback provision, which we've had, which I believe is much larger than lots of other states have, is actually not something that we see or hear voters using very much. And I think when we talk about how we want to move forward in an environment, what we're really looking for is making sure that we have built both the confidence, the security, and the accessibility for voters. It is, to Secretary Simon's point, it is a trade-off, but I think it's the right trade-off for voters, and it's what voters are asking us for.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Lee Torkelson.
Since we seem to have entered a bit of a debate on this, well, I've had no voter ask me to extend this early voting window. I don't know how we would get an accurate count over how many voters have asked for that. And the opportunity to claw back is dependent on the circumstances of that particular election. We could go many elections where there's very few clawback requests, but you could have an incident, as we have had in Minnesota history, where you would all of a sudden have a large number of voters that would want to claw back their ballots because of something that happened that affected the candidates in the campaign. So you're advantaging some people, unidentified amount of people that want this larger window of early voting, from which I've heard from none of them. I don't know if they even exist, but apparently, according to you, they do. And you're directly disadvantaging another group of voters that might want to use, in some circumstances, this clawback provision. In addition to that, you're also burdening our local governments with a fairly significant expense of extending this early voting window because they have to have personnel on duty, et cetera, real expenses that will cost local government in order to do this work.
Any additional member discussion? Representative Wong.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On the early voting, what processes are not the same between Election Day and the few weeks of early voting?
Secretary Simon?
Mr. Chair and Representative Kwan, I'm going to hand it over to Ms. Freeman on this one. I'll speak for myself. I'm not sure you're asking for the differences, basically what the bill changes as to early voting.
Representative Kwan.
No. I am specifically asking on Election Day, you've got a balance of election judges. You have a lot of processes with two. You have a form for a poll challenger, and you have certain things around, you know, observing and verification. And I know there are some of those things that are not present during the early voting. I would like to illuminate, you know, you tell me everything that is different between Election Day and the early voting.
Nicole Freeman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. So I haven't done a side-by-side of the statutes applicable on Election Day to the statutes that would be applicable under early voting. I can talk a little bit about the procedure of early voting, which might help us. Get to a few of the points. So early voting is operated at a county or a city location that is designated by them. Election officials, so either deputized clerks or county deputized county auditors, in addition to election judges, can authorize early voting, can administer early voting. Two election officials still need to sign the ballot to verify that the right ballot was handed out to the voter. The voter's information is verified in the same way that it is on Election Day, confirming their name, their address, and if needed, their date of birth. If they need to update their registration, they can use Election Day voter registration methods similar to Election Day. If there's a challenge to voter eligibility, those can also be administered at that time. Once a voter gets their ballot, they are able to go vote it. Statutes around someone can assist them if they would like somebody to assist them, or a voter may use an assistive voting device, which has to be made available at all of these locations. And then the voter places their ballot into the tabulator. If there are any errors on the ballot, those errors, as on Election Day, are recognized by the tabulator. The ballots return to the voter, and then the voter can decide if they would like to spoil their ballot and make those changes so that their votes can be properly counted. After that time, the ballots are secured each evening with the ballot board, and then are included in the absentee totals, which are combined with Election Day vote totals and reported on election night.
Representative Blum?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Several weeks ago, this question was asked. The statement was made that a list would be provided to us so that we could understand. I haven't seen a list, and I'm just surprised that they aren't prepared to answer a question that was asked many weeks ago. And so when can I and other members on the committee actually see the list that was promised weeks ago of the differences between, because if you remember when a bill was presented, they said that they had to shut down a little bit earlier the day before Election Day in order to get all of the processes and things ready, which indicated there are differences on Election Day, saying there's a difference between appointed deputy clerks and the regular election judges, because we have in statute specifications for major parties and balancing, and certain activities would have one from each of the major parties participating. So again, I am frustrated that I can't get an answer, especially weeks after I initially asked that. So how are we going to actually get the answer to a question?
Thank you, Representative Quam. I thought Nicole Freeman did give a thorough answer to that, but I will, getting a sense of deja vu here, Representative Quam.
Mr. Chair, I'm trying to avoid the deja vu. Sure. Specifically, what are the differences? Okay. Saying that there's a challenge, well, what is the difference? There's a difference between a specific process for a challenger on Election Day and the other.
I apologize, Representative Quam. We did actually get some materials in there, but we neglected to send it out. We will send it out to you right now. Things ended a little chaotically a couple weeks ago, so I think probably in the excitement of all that, we didn't send it out, but the Secretary of State's office did provide us with that information, and we will send it right immediately. I think it's probably already been sent.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If they already generated the information, why are they not capable of actually testifying the specifics to the question? So, in other words, you say, well, they've sent out the answer, but they apparently don't have the answer at the testifying table, and that concerns me, plus the fact that I don't think anyone on this side that I'm aware of were shared the answer, especially when the question came from this side of the aisle. But I'll move on to my other questions, I suppose, if I may.
Sure, proceed.
Thank you. In Article 2, Section 108, National Popular Vote, I'd like to find out from the author, why should our electors be chosen by non-Minnesota voters?
Thank you. I guess that's a question directed at me since I'm the author of that provision. Electors would still be selected by Minnesota. The actual identity of the electors would still be selected by Minnesotans, but there's nothing sacrosanct in awarding the electoral votes to the winner of the popular vote within a state. I know, we heard testimony from people that Maine and Nebraska do it by congressional district, so this is just an alternate system that I think comports with what a lot of people expect out of their election system, namely the person who gets the most votes wins. So this just says that we can choose the identity of the electors, but they go to the person who has won the national popular vote. I think it's a pretty straightforward system. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The specific question is justification why voters outside the state of Minnesota get to choose who our electors are voting for. I mean, when we were set up as a country, the state specifically gave each state the power for their voice in the selection and for their electors to be counted. By allowing, it doesn't matter, according to this section, how the voters of Minnesota decide. The decision is by people outside the state of Minnesota. Now, we accept that the total result across the nation is determined by the total, you know, it's by the nation, by the states across the nation. But our voice, even if it isn't on the side of the victor, should not be stifled and silenced by the, you know, it's like saying we don't really matter because people outside will determine who's going to get our electors' votes. And that is at the crux. And I have not heard any discussion of why we should be abdicating the rights of our voters, the voice of our voters, in this point.
I guess I would say our votes, if assuming this becomes law and enough states ratify it that account for a majority of the Electoral College, our votes would count just as much as anyone else. And I would argue they would probably count more than they do now because we're not, you know, I think presidential elections the last few terms have focused on Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania, and we've kind of been relegated to irrelevancy. And I think this, you know, the national popular vote under national popular, and then also if you look at the fact of, you know, the small states have disproportionate impact because regardless of their size, they get three electoral votes. I think this just makes our vote matter as much as anyone else, which is frankly in a democracy is the way it should be. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I understood that we were founded as a democratic republic and that actually I remember this century, the couple of decades, multiple presidential candidates speaking in our state. But I guess moving on to the next question, the Article 3 and the sections 12 through 18 go over permanent absentee voter list. I would wonder if the testifiers could illuminate what are the proactive processes in place to remove people that have moved out of the state or deceased, and what is the frequency during voting?
Secretary Simon.
Mr. Chair and Representative Quam, first I need to say, and no respect intended to the committee, I need to leave. I have a hard out at 9:30, so no disrespect. You're in the very capable hands of Ms. Freeman. I would just say, though, to your earlier point, Representative Quam, we were invited here to just discuss our budget. That's not to say we shouldn't be on notice, that we could ask other questions on the bill, but I just hope you understand that our narrow mission this morning was to talk technically about the budget. To your point about voters who leave the state, I think that was your question, right, or are deceased, how do we determine that? One key way, and it's been in the news lately, is to join a national coalition or consortium of states called ERIC, E-R-I-C, it's an acronym. 33 states right now are members of ERIC, hopefully more to join, and we talk to those other states in a formal and official way and compare data so that we can determine if someone leaves Minnesota and moves to Iowa, we want to know that. We don't want them stuck on the voter rolls. And the reasons why this organization is important, I think, it's just as a matter of common sense, I think all of us know this. How many people have you ever met? My answer is zero. Who move out of the state, and of all the things you do when you move, you have your mail forwarded and your, you know, bills and you, you know, take yourself off various lists. I've never met anyone who calls their county auditor or their city elections person and says, please take me off the voter rolls, I'm moving out of the state. I've never met that person. And as a result, it's a common problem in states to have people linger on the voter rolls for some number of years just because they didn't do that. And so we have joined this organization called ERIC, which helps solve that problem. So it has to do with deceased people. It has to do with people moving out of state. It even has to do with people moving within the state. You don't want someone on the voter rolls in Byron who really has moved to Hopkins. And so part of the way we do that is through collective action with 33 other states.
Thank you, Secretary Simon. I apologize. I kind of called an audible there and asked you to stay up.
No, that's okay. That's okay. And I want to make clear, Mr. Chair, we're always on notice that we're here to ask any question you have of us. I wasn't suggesting that it was improper for you to ask those questions. I'm just saying that our particular presentation here was on the budget. Ms. Freeman is happy to stand for any questions on any item of this bill. I thank you, and you all know how to get a hold of me offline. You can text me, you can call me, you can set up a meeting. We'll come to your office if you ever have questions or concerns. Thank you.
Yep. Thank you, Secretary Simon. Representative Kwong.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In my question, I asked about the permanent absentee voter list. So in other words, you're sending out ballots. And I also asked, you know, the periodicity, because it's important that, especially with many weeks of absentee voting and ballots being sent out, if we can assure our people that we aren't sending out a bunch of absentee ballots to people that are deceased or have moved, because that's the one thing I've heard from a lot of people is they, you know, they're getting correspondence in regards to voting from other people. And if we're doing this permanent absentee list, I want to make sure that we can reassure the people out there that we've got a process that every week, and especially before we send out absentee ballots, that we update and we clean this up so we don't have ballots sitting out there. A lot of the thing is not just to prevent something happening, but it's to reassure our citizens that we have integrity, we've got checks and balances, so they don't doubt and get upset. It saves a lot of aggravation if we can do that. So if we can have if I can have the answer to the periodicity and timing of the proactive process to clean up people that have passed away or moved from this permanent absentee voter list.
Nicole Freeman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Yes, so the counties, the Secretary of State's office receives monthly reports from the Department of Health as well as the Social Security Administration to report on deaths. Those reports are then sent down to the counties for the counties to process. And so voter records are updated as it relates to deaths on a monthly basis. We also receive notice of death county auditors' offices will receive notice of death from family members calling in or sending written notice to alert people that, you know, their loved one has passed away as sort of part of their process. And so that's another way that the records are updated as well.
Representative Kwong.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so it's sent down to the counties. If I'm not sure who was on the committees that heard the first audit in 2018, but the second audit by the legislative auditor did a sampling and discovered the counties were not cleaning up their voter registration. I'm sure I can resend out the link to both those audits. And you know, that is somewhat troubling that we don't have a proactive verification that this has been done. I know that there have been other states where they've discovered that a few hundred thousand people weren't cleaned up off the list. And so I just want to make sure that when people hear that, they would be assured that Minnesota had a better, more effective process. I don't think I've quite heard a firm enough answer on that, but in the thing of time, in Article 3, Section 9, AVR, I'd like to find out what the proactive verifications are run on AVR, especially considering that in the current budget there's about $110 million for MA for people that are not don't have legal status in our state. So that must be a fair amount of people to make sure that, you know, MA and all these other processes we're adding to AVR to go back and make sure that there haven't been mistakes made. Because again, in the voter registration audits, the two that were done, and this was in 2018, 2016 timeframe, it predates a lot of the more recent concerns. There were issues that popped up, and I want to make sure that we've learned, it's been a few years now, that there's a proactive, especially if we're expanding AVR across all these different programs where there are, the MA, didn't they say there's 1.5 million verification, or maybe it's a really huge number that they were giving, and that's just one of the new processes for the automatic voter registration. So that's where my concern is coming from.
Nicole Freeman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, and Representative Quam. So on lines 88.14, and then I think a little further down. Now I'm wondering if I'm, I guess maybe the better place to go is 88.2829, and sort of that subparagraph B. That is stating that applicants' information must not be transmitted unless the applicant provided documentation of U.S. citizenship, or records maintained by DPS indicate that they've provided that documentation during previous transactions. So that's for DPS. DHS, those provisions also exist, and that's on 89.28, that subparagraph B. Another note on DHS, the Department of Human Services, they have let us know, and I'll let Representative Greenman clarify if I don't say something exactly right as regards to this, but DHS has let us know that they don't have federal authority to share the data for the applications that we're looking at right now. They need federal authorization, and so that is still a work in progress. DHS does have its own process where it's verifying against federal databases the citizenship status of its applicants. As the language states, it would only be forwarding on those who do have citizenship status through this process.
We do have another member on the list now, too.
No, I did notice that. I'm glad that you're saying it's not supposed to happen. But the Secretary of State, our current Secretary of State, testifying several years ago in regards to the tens of thousands of flagged badge registrations by the required HAVA Social Security Administration verification website indicated a large portion of those were probably typos or mistakes in data entry. And if we've got the Secretary of State in committee testifying that the people working with this data are making large numbers of mistakes, during election cycle, one was 16,000, another was 15,000 that were flagged by the Federal Social Security Administration site that HAVA requires some verifications if some registrations are missing some information. And the Secretary of State on video, and we could find that video, stated the vast majority of those, which to me would be in the thousands, were data entry or clerical mistakes. Now we're going to have hundreds of thousands of opportunities for automatic voter registration. And if we take the same proportionality of mistakes that were testified as probably the cause of this other issue, that would be tens of thousands of mistakes. So I would hope that there was a re-verification of this data after it was sent and transmitted, just to be careful, because of I don't have a warm fuzzy feeling from the information I'm hearing, especially on past testimony from the Secretary of State.
Thank you. Representative Bonner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was hoping maybe to add a little bit of clarity and ask Nicole a few questions. The first one is, you know, the first question was asked about the differences between early voting and Election Day. If I understand correctly, and please correct me if I'm not stating this accurately, between the process that we use for early voting and the process that we use for the Election Day, the general processes or daily process and procedures are identical. If I understand correctly, the only difference between an early voting day and an election day is whether or not we tabulate the results of all of those votes received that day at the end of the day. So in other words, during early voting, while we allow people to vote and we collect those ballots, we do not actually tabulate the results on those dates. But we follow the same process and procedure during the day, the same checks and balances each and every day as we do on election day. However, on election day, at the end of the day, we count up the votes.
Is that an accurate statement?
Nicole Freeman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Yes, that would be correct.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
I'll call you next.
Thank you.
Representative Bonner has the floor.
Thank you, Ms. Freeman. And then the other question was asked about, we were talking about early voting and when we cease that on the day before election day. And there was a statement made a couple weeks ago that they may want to close a couple of hours early in order to prepare for the following day. It is my understanding that in most cities and counties, early elections happen generally in one polling location. They designate a centralized place for ease of use, right? So that's usually the city hall or the local courthouse, that sort of thing. But the next day, they will be switching from that one location, and all of the folks coordinating all of the election process for Election Day will now be expanding their efforts to every precinct across that location, correct? Or that area. So it seems logical to me that when you go from one polling location and you have to coordinate the logistics for expanding to multiple precincts, say 10 precincts to 20 precincts, whatever that number may be in any given area, that it makes sense that you may want to have a little bit of additional time to make sure that each of those locations is set up properly, that they have all the right materials, that their staffing is appropriate, that their machines are all set up and ready to go for the next day, so that there are no delays or issues on election day, which could, of course, make people feel uneasy. That is my understanding of how that works, having been a former election judge and in through this process. But I want to make sure that my understanding and my experience are matching with what's actually happening. Can you verify for me if that's actually your interpretation as well?
Nicole Freeman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, yes, I think that the point that the county administrators were making is that on the Monday evening or ahead of Election Day, they're preparing materials and making sure that everything is up to date and ready to go out to the polling locations.
Representative Bonner.
Thank you for that. I really appreciate that. And I will dig a little bit deeper, but I also wanted to talk about the idea of how we may have some registrations where there isn't 100% verification. It is my understanding that at present,
whenever there is a question about a registration, like something doesn't match 100%. Maybe they have one that says John William Smith or John W. Smith. And if they don't match exactly, it could get kicked out as being unverified. Now, they have the same date of birth. They might have the same address. But one says John W. Smith, one says John William Smith, right? And it's my understanding that when there are questions like that, that those go to the counties for verification, and they can follow a manual verification process to make sure that there's a reasonable expectation that those two records actually match. Can you confirm that that is accurate, Ms. Freeman?
Nicole Freeman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, so that is the process, and there are certain databases, particularly the Social Security database, that do require an exact match. So one example that I know the Secretary has used before with this other staff member's permission is one of our staff members has a hyphenated last name. His last name, his record was kicked back as being unable to be verified because the hyphen was missing as it went up to the Social Security Administration. And so there is a manual process where the auditors can look. And then if they still are unsure, if it isn't something obvious like a hyphen missing, they can they'll challenge the voter. There's actually a letter that goes out to the voter that asks them to provide more information so that their record can be verified.
Representative Bonner.
Thank you, Ms. Freeman. I really appreciate all those clarifications. And I know that, we have pretty robust systems for AVR that look at, or the DPS, excuse me, that can be, will be the same under automatic voter registration is my understanding, but that they follow three basic principles. They verify that you are who you say you are, you live where you say you live, and that you are an eligible voter. In the case of DPS, for example, we have folks who spend their entire day looking at documentation, 8 hours a day, minimum 5 hours a week. They spend their time looking at documentation to verify all three of those things. And in order for anyone to be able to pass that information over to the SVRS, they have to have met each of those criteria. Is that accurate, Ms. Freeman?
Nicole Freeman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, AVR, once the data gets to the counties, it will go through all the same checks as a voter registration that would come in any other way.
Representative Bonner.
Thank you, Ms. Freeman. I just wanted to clear those things up and be very clear on the record about those, and I really appreciate your clarifications.
Thank you. Representative Blum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To say that they're identical for election day and pre-election day doesn't match the discussion that we had earlier, doesn't match the few points I brought up that in statute there's a certain process that's election judges and not deputy register or auditors. So there's a difference. That's not exactly the same, because the reason why they have two election judges, one from each, and a balance between the major parties is for reassuring the public that the system has a built-in check in these processes. And that is not identical when you don't abide by that section of statute. So by definition, it isn't the same. And when they decide to get me the lists for election day and early voting, then I can probably supply you with a more thorough list of the deltas between the two, but identical is not the appropriate usage in the comparison. And I do like what the Motor Vehicle Department does with licenses and that, but I also recall having sheriffs and police officers that got a new driver's license where either the picture wasn't them or the name wasn't them. So mistakes do happen. And the more that you have occurrences, the more that those mistakes can. And frankly, to say that a hyphen or a typo on the name is going to be the cause of all 16,000 plus errors that showed up and documented during a committee hearing and the Legislative Audit Commission audit of the registration system for the state is, I think, a bit naive. I can accept there being a portion, but even if it's 80%, you still have thousands of bad registrations. And the discussion about, well, we have a check and balance by the counties when a second sampling audit was done because of concerns of the data that was being shared during the first audit, that second audit found discrepancies in multiple counties and that they didn't clean their lists. They didn't prevent challenged voters from just saying, no, I can vote, raise their hand, and handing them a ballot. There are issues, and to ignore the concerns of a fair portion of our state is not what we should be doing here. We should be reassuring instead of trying to explain it away by, oh, it's just because we have a hyphen or not a hyphen. You know, frankly, a lot of other states don't have the percentage of flagged bad registrations that Minnesota has. And this is just a portion that are required to go through the HAVA verification site. So to try and feed a statement so that someone can say, oh, yes, that's true, doesn't change what the actual facts are, doesn't change what independent entities have done, and I don't see anyone saying the legislative auditor is not an independent agency, and doesn't change the fact that Minnesota doesn't follow HAVA. We're one of three states that are allowed an exemption from following HAVA. And that should cause us to be more diligent because we're not following what the vast majority of the nation is doing. And HAVA is Help America Vote Act. So, you know, if you want specific stuff, once I get the response from the Secretary of State, I'll make sure every member of this committee receives a summarized update on that. But I will sit back now.
Representative Torkelson, you pulled your mic towards you.
I did, Mr. Chair. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And it's still along these lines of extending the early voting window and how this has an impact on our election system. Ms. Freeman, could you talk a little bit about the impact of these changes on poll watchers and election judges and how we relate their work to the election process?
Nicole Freeman.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. So election judges can participate in the early voting process. They would be hired and, you know, assigned to work by the county or by the city if they're authorized to administer absentee voting. As far as challengers go, challengers are allowed at in-person absentee locations and can challenge a voter's eligibility based on personal knowledge as Minnesota statute allows.
Lead Torkelson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Ms. Freeman, for that answer. It seems to me the odds of poll watchers showing up for weeks in advance of election to monitor our elections is rather slim. I'm quite sure it's a volunteer situation. I don't know about the election judges. They aren't required, are they?
Nicole Freeman?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Lee Torkelson. No, they're not required to be participants, but they are allowable, and counties and cities would make the determination based on staffing if they would need to bring in additional folks. And oftentimes those additional temporary staff, for example, that they hire may be election judges.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And again, this extended period of time is going to cause financial burdens on our counties to administer these elections. And if they're going to take the trouble to hire election judges in addition, that's more expense. It seems to me the likelihood of that happening is slim in most cases. Identifying quite a difference between election day and this early voting period. I think that was a statement, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. I don't have any additional members on the list, so, and we are approaching time here, so I will just mention the amendment deadline is 10:30 in the morning, 24 hours before our hearing, so 10:30 in the morning on Thursday. However, I know our nonpartisan staff has another committee to staff Thursday morning, so if you're able to at least get the amendment prepared by tonight, I guess it would be, that would probably be preferable, and you can certainly submit it then at 10:30 if you prefer to do that, but just out of respect for nonpartisan staff, I think that would be helpful. This has been posted for a couple days now. But I should mention also that if an amendment puts the bill out of balance from the target, I will not be accepting those because we do have budget targets we need to work within, or those will be out of order. So if it's going to take money, if it's going to have a cost, the money should come from somewhere. So any questions, Representative Perkelson?
So, Mr. Chair, along those lines, if an amendment eliminates a cost, does that put the bill out of balance?
I don't think it would. I mean, it would just go to the bottom line, I guess.
Thank you.
Yes. So try maybe perhaps telegraphing your intent there, Lee Torkelson.
Oh, it's not. We've been telegraphing for weeks.
Okay.
And we will continue to telegraph.
Sure. No, appreciate that. Appreciate that. So you probably want to keep the DE amendments in your packet also, so we don't need to reprint those, or just leave that and we can. Our staff can put them back in, so unless you want to take it with you to read, I suppose. So with that, seeing no additional questions, we are adjourned.